If there was ever a man who must have felt like a stranger in a strange land, it was Francis Bacon. Other great people seem to have been born at exactly the right moment, when civilization had been prepared and was ready for their ideas and inventions. Still others seem to have been born just at the sunset of one age and the dawn of another. And even though their ideas were ridiculed and opposed, they paved the way for the next era of human growth. But if there were such a thing as mistakes, Bacon would almost seem to be one. He was like a man from a different age and a different civilization, plopped down in the wrong place at the wrong time. His thoughts, his interests, and his visions didn't conform in the least with his contemporaries, who in every way failed to understand or appreciate him, and there was a lot to appreciate. Bacon was a philosopher, an essayist, a statesman, a lawyer, a man with a sharp, dry wit, original thoughts, powerful speaking skills, and an inspired wisdom about life. He is almost as quotable as his contemporary Shakespeare. In fact, his observations about the human condition were so keen and his writing so eloquent that for many years some scholars believed he was the true author of Shakespeare's works. Now most people discredit that theory, but it doesn't matter. The life and work of Francis Bacon can stand on their own. Bacon is most admired and remembered for his contributions to science, a field that didn't even exist in his own time, the late 1500s and early 1600s. He proposed a theory of scientific knowledge based on observation and experiment that came to be known as the inductive method. When science and inductive reasoning finally became popular during the Enlightenment, 150 years after he died, the men of that age, such as the French philosopher Diderot, hailed him as the father of modern science. Today, still, he's regarded as one of the earliest and most influential supporters of empirical or experimental science, and the man who helped develop the scientific method of solving problems. His interests, his ideas, and even his personality belonged not to the age in which he lived, but to the future. Bacon was born on January 22, 1561, in a sprawling manor that belonged to his father, Nicholas Bacon, Lord Keeper to Queen Elizabeth I. What a Lord Keeper actually keeps is the seal of the monarch, which validates all important documents and decisions. It's the highest judicial position in the land. Francis was a bright and serious child, whom the Queen referred to as "my little Lord Keeper." Elizabeth was a strong monarch, known for her capriciousness with the members of her court, and especially the men. She took great pleasure in keeping them guessing, in arousing their jealousies, in bestowing and withdrawing her favors at whim. Francis Bacon would serve her until the end of her reign, but she would always deny him the highest offices, and he often lived with poverty and misfortune in the midst of luxury. To understand Bacon and his uniqueness, it's necessary to understand the times in which he lived, known as Elizabethan England, because of the strength and influence of its remarkable queen. There was much to admire about this extraordinary age, including its achievements in language and literature. But there was much to cause revulsion, too. The legacy of the English court was a bloody one, dating back to Henry VIII and even before him. It was a world of absolute royal power, of corruption and terror. The ruler alone defined what treason was. People rose to power in one instant and fell from grace the next. Everyone who entered their career had reason to wonder if they'd finish it on a scaffold. The rulers themselves were always half expecting the conspiracy or the knife or sword that would end their reign. The solution seemed to be, make sure you're the one who strikes first. Spies and informers were everywhere, as were bribes and blackmail. Crowds of bloodthirsty citizens swarmed to the public squares to watch people being tortured or executed. The heads of those executed were propped along the city gates as a warning to others. It was Francis Bacon who wrote of his generation that they were wearing out days few and evil. Through all the violence, the vanity and greed, and the treachery and ambition, Bacon walked calmly and coolly, detached and observing, avoiding most of the turmoil that surrounded him until the last few years of his life, when it consumed and destroyed him too. As a child, it was said that Bacon played alone a lot. He was once found in some rocky hills, experimenting with the sounds of an echo. By the time he was 12, he was already in college, unusually young even for those days when university schooling started early. The college he was sent to was Cambridge, a place that bored him, and where the curriculum was dominated by bitter theological disputes. He later described the faculty as men of sharp wits, shut up in the cells of a few authors, chiefly Aristotle, their dictator. Aristotle, he said, was unfruitful. At Cambridge, just as at Oxford and most other higher institutions, learning meant nothing more than relearning the ideas of the past. And Bacon's mind belonged to the future. Besides his disenchantment with his studies, Bacon suffered from chronic illness. He had a naturally weak constitution, and although he lived into his 70s, was often unwell. Nevertheless, he stuck it out at Cambridge until he had his degree, and was home again when he was 15. Since he came from a legal family, it was only natural that his next step was to enter Gray's Inn, where he began the study of law. That was interrupted a year later, when his father sent him abroad as a companion to the English ambassador to France. For 3 years, Bacon was in France, soaking up the intellectual wealth of the French Renaissance, reading poets and philosophers, and developing the love of literature that was so evident in his later life, when he was back at the less-than-literate English court. He had a disturbing dream during his stay in France. He saw his father's house all plastered over with black mortar. 3 days later, he discovered that Lord Keeper Nicholas Bacon was dead. The premature death of his father left Bacon in difficult straits. He was the youngest of several children and received only a pittance in the inheritance. This year, when he was 18, was the beginning of financial difficulties and insecurity that would dog him forevermore. Bacon was young, eager, well-educated and trained, and forced to beg for help from relatives. He wrote to an uncle saying, "I have taken all knowledge to be my province," but the uncle, unimpressed by this sweeping ambition, denied him assistance. Somehow, Bacon managed to finish his legal training, and in time progressed through several posts until he became the Queen's Counsel. When he was 23 years old, he was elected to Parliament. As a counsel to the Queen, it was Bacon's chief task to give her legal advice, advice often laced with his dry wit. On one such occasion, Elizabeth sought his views about an author who had released a book about Henry IV. The book angered the Queen, because she felt that under the pretense of writing history, he was really criticizing her own policies. Elizabeth summoned her legal officers, including Bacon, and asked if it were possible to prosecute the writer on charges of treason. Bacon responded, "I can't answer for there being treason in it, but certainly it contains much felony." This surprised the Queen, who asked him, "How? Wherein is this felony?" Bacon, referring to an ancient Roman historian, replied, "In many passages which he has stolen from Tacitus." While Elizabeth reigned, Bacon's life was spent in the background at court, where he wrote her political statements and gave her legal advice. He remarked later, "My good old mistress was wont to call me her watch-candle, because it pleased her to say I did continually burn, and yet she suffered me to waste almost to nothing." He was patient with her, but he was frustrated. Secretly, he complained of how she kept him dangling for political favors, and how she used her stinginess and fickleness to torment him. He wasn't alone in this, of course. It was one of Queen Elizabeth's chief political techniques, and she used it not just on members of her court and her lovers, but on rulers of other European countries. Queen Elizabeth seemed also to hold back on her respect of Bacon, because he didn't fit the aristocratic mold of the other men at court. He had no estates, no personal wealth, and no noble titles. She once visited Bacon's house, at a time when he was living in the gracious Tudor manor that had been owned by his father, and which, by today's standards, was a mansion. But the queen, used to the lavish estates of the great lords who used to compete to entertain her, found Bacon's house rather plain. "What a little house you have gotten," she commented. Bacon, ever cool and tactful, replied, "The house is well, but it is you, Your Majesty, who have made me too great for the house." Although not given much credit at court, Bacon was influential in Parliament, where he had a seat in the House of Commons, and was known for his brilliant speeches. Even there, however, he was constantly at the mercy of Her Majesty. He aroused her ire often, once in particular when he opposed a tax bill that he thought would increase the suffering of the poor. From that moment on, he was denied any advancement at court. After he lost the favor of the queen, Bacon was taken under the wing of the Earl of Essex, a favorite romantic interest of the Virgin Queen Elizabeth, who had become weary of her fickleness. He became Bacon's self-assigned patron and recommended him for several posts, all of which the queen rejected. But the rise to favor of the earl was followed, as usually happened, by a fall, and his head, too, ended up on a post at the city gate. The death of the Earl of Essex, who had conspired to revolt against her, was the beginning of Queen Elizabeth's undoing. From then on, she was moody and unstable, sometimes picking up a sword and thrashing at her curtains, possibly to make sure no assassins were lurking in its folds. Bacon had tried to give Essex advice, had tried to steer him away from his own self-destructive passions, with no success. Now, because the public had adored the impulsive but brave Earl, Bacon was given the sorry task of writing a state paper to explain the execution. His affection for his patron was too apparent in the first draft, and Elizabeth demanded revisions. She exclaimed, "It is my Lord of Essex on every page. You can't forget your old respect for the traitor. Strike it out. Make it Essex." Bacon was 42 when Elizabeth died, leaving no heirs. The throne was taken by James of Edinburgh, a Scot, a learned man, a favorite of the rebel Essex. His rise gave Bacon hope, and immediately he set out to win his favor. But it wasn't an easy favor to win. Although the king kept some of the same men at their same posts, he didn't renew Bacon's. Instead, Bacon was one of several hundred people James had knighted in a mass ceremony which carried little prestige. Then he offered him a small pension and a post as King's Counsel, an almost meaningless term, since there were dozens of such councils. In despair, Bacon considered withdrawing from court life to become a recluse and a scholar. It was only a fantasy. Bacon had been raised and trained for a life of action in service to the state. Nevertheless, when that action was taken from him, he turned in the meantime to writing a book. The book was written quickly, in hopes he could present it to King James and win his favor. Instead, it won the favor of history. Called The Advancement of Learning, this work undertaken in frustration and written in haste was destined to become one of the greatest of all time. It contains the essence of Bacon's inner life and his hopes for humanity. He dedicated it to the king, who barely understood a word of it. He was not alone. At the time he published his great work, Bacon was dismissed as a fool. His literate colleagues in law, government, and the universities found his ideas eccentric at best, ridiculous at worst. Both his rulers, Elizabeth and then James, had been educated along traditional lines, with a respect for classical thought, In other words, they were, like everyone else, attached to the past. Neither of them saw any value in the unconventional ideas of their servant Francis Bacon, ideas which would, in fact, overturn the entire school system. The more he wrote, the more he was viewed with suspicion. He was close, so close to the seat of power, and yet he couldn't influence it at all. In despair, he had his works translated into Latin, because he believed his own country was so backwards that even its language wouldn't survive. In spite of the indifference and the criticism, he never lost faith in his own ideas or writing, and did his best to seal them from ignorance and protect them for the future. The summer after he wrote The Advancement of Learning, Bacon married Alice Barnum, the daughter of a London churchman. It was not a happy marriage, and Bacon was reported to be cold in matters of romance and love. Once he had even stated that he that hath wife and children hath given hostages to fortune, for they are impediments to great enterprises, either of virtue or mischief. Certainly the best works, and of greatest merit for the public, have preceded them from the unmarried or childless men. Yet there was a romantic hidden behind this cold mask somewhere, for in his will he left all he had to a woman he once admired, who had rejected him and married another. Although King James took little interest in the advancement of learning, he took a big interest in Bacon's career in Parliament. Bacon was a strong, persuasive speaker and highly respected by his colleagues. Now this was a skill that could be useful to a king. In 1603, the big conflict in Parliament was over the church and political union between England and Scotland. King James realized he needed an experienced statesman to give him advice and mediate between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. For 16 years, Bacon gave that advice, trying to convince the king to limit his own powers and increase the rights of his subjects. It was, like almost everything else in which he invested his hopes, a fruitless endeavor. In spite of the advice that went unheeded, the king grew to trust Bacon more and more on practical matters and matters of state. Like Queen Elizabeth, he sought Bacon's input on everything from the mundane and trivial to the all-important, and like Elizabeth, he often received his advice wrapped in his counselor's dry wit. Like the time his court was visited by an envoy of France. The envoy was a tall, lanky man of dull personality and equally dull intelligence. After he'd left his audience with the king, James turned to Bacon and asked his opinion of the man. "Your Majesty," replied Bacon, "people of such dimensions are like 4 or 5-story houses. The upper rooms are the most poorly furnished." 4 years into the reign of King James, Bacon was made Solicitor General, an important but demanding office that tried his failing health. During all this, the royal treasury was steadily going into the red, and the taxes being levied on the public were becoming more and more burdensome. In the House of Commons, opposition to James was increasing, the first sign of the coming Puritan Revolution. Bacon read those signs. Everyone else refused to see them. During these years, there was much on Bacon's mind. He left behind a notebook in which he jotted all his thoughts, reminders, and goals. They include such varied topics as reminding himself to flatter a possible patron, to study the weaknesses of a rival, to put prisoners in the Tower of London to the useful task of conducting experiments, and records of his income, debts, the king's business, his gardens, his health, including symptoms and medications, and a promise to learn to control his breathing and not to interrupt in conversations. He was casual, perhaps even careless, about the fluctuations in his wealth, which were often on the downside. He often spent money lavishly for public purposes. Once he was the sole financier of a court theatrical event, and he was a liberal spender in his household. "Money is like muck," he said, "not good except it be spread." It would have been lucky for Bacon if he could have spread his influence at court as well as he spread his money. When the Secretary of State died in 1612, Bacon, then 51, applied for the post. He was turned down because of his close association with the increasingly hostile Parliament, and the post was given to an inexperienced competitor. In exchange, Bacon was made Attorney General. In that post, he struggled and succeeded at keeping the Constitution intact and protecting what laws and liberties England's subjects had, while also preserving the King's honor, a task that required enormous skill, diplomacy, and wisdom. Although the King was wary of him, he still trusted his advice, so much so that in 1618, when Bacon was 57, he was made Lord Chancellor of England, which brought with it, besides greater power, the title of Baron. Shortly after, he was awarded an even better title, Viscount. As Lord Chancellor, Bacon served as a judge, and his cases, like all his work, were blessed with both his wisdom and his humor. He once presided over a case in which the plaintiff was a man named Hogg. Hogg jokingly suggested that he should be left off the case on the grounds that he must be related to the judge, for, he claimed, Hogg must be kin to Bacon. "Not until it has been hung," was Bacon's response. The period he served as Lord Chancellor marked the peak of Bacon's political career, but it was a peak that would last only 3 years before a tragic and final fall from grace occurred. In Parliament, the rage of men opposed to the King was turned instead on the safe target of the King's Lord Chancellor, Francis Bacon, even though he was the one man who had tried consistently to limit royal excesses and protect the state. The treachery they used was typical of the times. Old enemies started rumors. Standard gifts of homage that everyone gave were termed, in the case of Bacon, as briberies, and he would be blamed for mistakes made by his servants. Finally, they charged him with corruption in office. Dismayed, Bacon told the King that if this is what it meant to be Lord Chancellor, he was sure no one with any sense would accept the position. The assault on his character occurred when he was suffering from another illness, and Bacon pleaded for extra time to meet the charges, explaining that genuine sickness and not cowardice was the reason for his request. The House of Lords used the time to compile more charges. King James, unwilling to upset Parliament even more, failed to come to Bacon's defense. Instead, he advised Bacon, and advice from a king was the same thing as a command, to admit his guilt, and the crown would protect him. When Bacon left his audience with the king, he remarked, "I am the first sacrifice. I wish I may be the last." Bacon felt he owed King James a great deal. He was a man with no money, no land, and no title when James came to court, yet the king had raised him higher and higher. Now he was expendable for the protection of the monarchy. He obeyed his ruler and admitted his guilt, a dedicated servant to the end. The verdict was an astronomical fine, imprisonment in the Tower of London during the king's pleasure, banishment from office, and exclusion from Parliament and from a 12-mile radius centered at the king's residence. When the verdict was handed down, Bacon made the generous and ironic comment that, "I acknowledge the sentence just, and so fit for the Justice Chancellor that hath been in the 5 changes since Nicholas Bacon's time." What disturbed him most about his sentence was that it cut him off from his favorite library and from consultation with his physician. Bacon's stay in the Tower was short, but the help and protection James promised never came, and the name of Francis Bacon was never cleared. Even in the following eras, when his genius and prescience was discovered, people held back their full admiration because he was a man who had gone down in scandal. He was brilliant, but he took bribes. He was perceptive, but he was corrupt. Later, evidence indicated he was innocent and never influenced by bribery. But the shadow followed him right up to the 20th century. After his final fall from office, which occurred when he was 66, Bacon wrote like a man possessed, a man who knew his time was running out and there was much to say before he left. He seemed determined to disprove his own statement that men of age object too much, consult too long, adventure too little, repent too soon, and seldom drive business home to the full period, but content themselves with a mediocrity of success. Not this man of age. Bacon accomplished more of value in disgrace than he'd ever accomplished in high office. He wrote a digest of laws for the king, a history of Great Britain, biographies of the Tudor monarchs, and essays on educational reform. He drafted memorandums on usury and on the prospects of war with Spain. He even still wrote up papers of advice for the king, and he composed speeches he would never have the opportunity to deliver. Undeterred by what the world thought of him, Bacon published work after work after work, and began a correspondence with Italian thinkers so he could spread his views to that country. Even in adversity, even labeled a social and political failure, he went on with vigor, confidence, and patience. Once he had said, "The pencil of the Holy Ghost hath labored more in describing the afflictions of Job than the felicities of Solomon." He had said, too, "Prosperity is the blessing of the Old Testament. Adversity is the blessing of the new." It would seem his life, at the end, was overflowing with such blessings. Bacon's greatest grief was that he lost the favor of his king. A year or two into his seclusion, he was admitted to court to kiss the king's hand, but he was never granted a full pardon. It was Bacon's passion for experiment and science that finally led to his demise. In March of 1626, before the spring thaw had arrived, he took a coach ride in the snowy fields of Highgate, north of London. During the ride, the idea occurred to him that snow might be used as a way to preserve food. He stopped the coach and entered the house of a poor farming woman, where he purchased a chicken, killed it, and drew it, and then packed the interior of the carcass with snow. This task brought on such a chill that he felt too ill to return home. Instead, he went to the nearby house of an earl, where he was given a somewhat damp bed to recuperate in. The chill went into bronchitis, and then pneumonia, from which Bacon died within 3 days. The date was April 9th, 1626, and he was 71 years old. He had said in his last years, "I, frail in health, involved in civil studies, coming to the obscurest of all subjects without guide or light, have done enough, if I have construed the machine itself and the fabric, though I may not have employed or moved it." The verdict of history is that he did more than enough. It had always been the intention of Francis Bacon to write one large work, which he called Instauratio Magna, or Great Renewal. The renewal he spoke of was mastery over nature. He hoped his work would be a survey of all learning up to his time, and a new foundation upon which the structure of all knowledge could be built. But he completed only two of the 6 parts he hoped to write, the Advancement of Learning and the New Organon, which was a replacement for Aristotle's work, the Organon. He also wrote several essays and a book entitled The New Atlantis, a fictional account of an imaginary island where the inhabitants dedicate themselves to the cooperative study of science. It is the Advancement of Learning that is considered Bacon's greatest work. Its thrust can be summed up by his own words: "This is the foundation of all, for we are not to imagine or suppose, but to discover what nature does or may be made to do." In this one sentence lies the very heart of the modern scientific method and an entirely new approach to learning and knowledge. Bacon's emphasis was on inductive reasoning, the type of thinking where you start with a specific observed fact and from there go on to general laws and principles. Inductive reasoning wasn't new. The ancient Greeks, and particularly Aristotle, were familiar with it. But they had used it on metaphysical arguments, and seldom on nature. Furthermore, since their time, it had been forgotten. In fact, instead of using reason in any form, teachers, scholars, and would-be thinkers were simply relying on supposed truths already established by Aristotle and the ancients. Never did they test these truths. Never did they question or examine them. Original thought had ceased to exist. Bacon believed that all previous knowledge was doubtful because it was based on faulty logic. It was Bacon's conviction that if humankind could learn to understand nature, it would gain power over it. If it could discover truths, it could conquer disease, poverty, and even war. Now that may seem obvious. In the 16th and early 17th centuries, it was never even considered. In philosophy, Bacon sought to purge the mind of what he called idols, a word he used synonymous with error. These errors, he felt, came from four sources: from human nature, from individual temperament and experience, from language, and from false philosophies, which to him meant earlier philosophers, and especially the god of the period, Aristotle. To overcome these idols, one needed only to use the inductive method of investigation. He described four steps in that method. 1. Listing all known cases in which a phenomenon occurs. 2. Listing similar cases where the phenomenon doesn't occur. 3. Listing the cases in which the phenomenon occurs in differing degrees. And 4. Examination of the three lists. These steps would lead to the cause of the phenomenon. If a man will begin with certainties, he wrote, he shall end in doubts. But if he will be content to begin with doubts, he shall end in certainties. Francis Bacon was a man whose personal life was disappointing, if not devastating, yet through it all he remained confident of his destiny. Today, we take science and scientific thought for granted. So much are they a part of our everyday life that it seems as if they must always have existed, that these inclinations were innate to the human mind. But the truth is that in the vast span of time we call history, the scientific way of looking at things is brand new. Several great civilizations rose and fell without ever venturing into the fields of science or scientific philosophy. With the exception of ancient Greece, even our own Western civilization showed little trace of scientific interest before the last 3 or 4 centuries. Science, it would seem, does not rise from basic human instincts. Its rules and techniques have to be learned and practiced, removed from emotion and prejudice, and pursued with discipline and patience. At the time Bacon wrote, there were a few who were trying out the instruments of science, groping in the dark like blind men, tentative and unsure. Only he clearly perceived the role of science in human development, and how dramatically it would change and threaten civilization. Like a prophet, he saw its potential in education. He saw the importance of developing professional researchers, of promoting government support, and of continuing, from generation to generation, the line of scientific advancement. He predicted the importance of mathematics in science, offered definitions of biology and anthropology, wondered if the transmutation of species was possible, and invented the idea of controls in scientific experiments. Perhaps most outstanding of all, he warned against using scientific knowledge without what he called charity. He spoke of its potential danger at a time when there was no background, no history, no evidence to even suggest such danger. He advised it should be put to the uses of life, and wrote of the necessity of serving what he called the human republic, our common country. And all of this he did in a void, unaided and disbelieved. Now there is support for such efforts. Society has come to revere science and technology, to depend on them even, and not just for progress, but for necessities. Society, too, has learned to be wary of science and to consider its broader implications and most beneficial uses. Today, scientists work in cooperative efforts and in professional communities where they're supplied all the resources, money, and commiseration they need. Francis Bacon worked alone. He envisioned and dreamed in secret, experimented in the most restricted of circumstances, and had almost no one to turn to for help, support, or understanding. He was living in one century and peeking through the door of another century way beyond him. "I have lost much time with this age," he once wrote to a friend, "yet all he wrote of has come to pass, and all the men who restricted and opposed him have been nearly forgotten, while his name stands with Shakespeare's as the two beacons of the Elizabethan age. He may have, as he said, lost much with the age in which he lived, but what he gained back in the ages that followed was immeasurable."
This is the end of the session.